Hi, everyone. My name's Ben Shields, and welcome to Make Good, a monthly conversation with Australian artists, designers, and entrepreneurs that examines the role of design in shaping society and culture. Jeremy McLeod and the team from Breathe Architecture completed a self-driven apartment building called The Commons in 2014. It innovated the Melbourne apartment market by creating lovely, larger-than-usual apartments that found efficiencies and built community through simple moves that included shared laundries on the roof, shared productive gardens, no car parking, solar, and only one bathroom per apartment. The Commons apartments sold really well, even in a flat market. And with this success, Jeremy and the team thought that this might influence the way that some of their developer clients wanted to make apartments. But it didn't. And it led Jeremy and his partner Tam to start Nightingale Housing, a not-for-profit that produces financially, socially, and environmentally sustainable housing at cost. Since then, Nightingale has completed 4 buildings with another 12 on the way, including 1 in Ballarat and 3 interstate. They have won a number of awards and continue to innovate and trailblaze in an industry known for substandard apartment development. In this episode of the podcast, Jeremy and I delve into how and why Nightingale has evolved over its journey, the design principles the company sees as critical for its work, and more broadly, how to ensure that every architectural project can have an impact through the implementation of some fundamentals of sustainability that just make sense. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hey, Jeremy. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Ben. It's a pleasure.
Could you start by giving us a brief overview of your background and the reasons behind why you started Nightingale?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I'm one of the founders of Breathe Architecture. And I guess, you know, we've been working at Breathe for a number of years, thinking of ourselves not just as architects, but also kind of as advocates for the city, you know, really focusing on sustainability. And then in more recent times at Breathe, looking at the housing crisis, which was unfolding across our country. In 2013, Bonnie Herring at Breathe finished a project called The Commons. And it was this kind of approach by Breathe to kind of self-develop a building. So we got some other architects to come and invest in that project with us. We bought the site. We partnered with Small Giants, an impact investment group. And the idea was that we would deliver triple bottom line housing. So ideally zero car, zero carbon, you know, a building that focused on community and that was affordable, you know, and it was density done well in the right location, right next to a bike path and a train line. And so when we finished that project, you know, Bonnie was, you know, kind of acted as this kind of educational advocate where she would take other architects and property developers through and, you know, we had city councils coming through, and for a year we ran tours through the Commons, and particularly we were particularly interested in meeting with a bunch of other property developers and taking them through to say that there was a different way to develop, you know, property, that you could do something that was sustainable, that focused on building community, and that was incredibly saleable. And after about 18 months of that, the market really didn't shift that much, right? People said, oh, that's nice, but it's a blip on the radar. It's not a trend. It's not a, you know, a future forecast. It's just, a, you know, this particular aberration in the marketplace. And then, you know, our property developer clients still wanted us to do the same things that they'd always done. And so actually, you know, I took a couple of weeks off. I went to Barcelona with Tam and, you know, I sat there in Barcelona and kind of wound down for about a week and then just thought about, you know, what the future of Breathe would be, living in kind of, you know, this incredibly dense, incredibly beautiful, incredibly livable city. And, you know, I started to write the manifesto that then became the manifesto for Nightingale Housing. And I called back to Breathe Architecture. And spoke to them about the site across the road from the Commons. And so, and then started over the last, my second week in Barcelona, I bought the site across the road from the Commons off the existing owner with the money in our GST account as the deposit and started working on the manifesto that became Nightingale Housing, which was fundamentally the idea that if the industry won't fix the broken, if the housing industry won't fix the broken housing model, then perhaps it's up to us architects to actually roll up our sleeves and get started on it. And then, you know, I came back, you know, from Barcelona with Tam. We bought the site across the road. We started work on it immediately. And then we wrote, you know, I took another week off work and I went and sat in my apartment at the Commons and I wrote, you know, what was, yeah, the Nightingale housing kind of, you know, the Nightingale housing model, which was fundamentally this idea that, you know, we could crowdsource the equity for this project. We didn't need a developer per se, that we could democratize the capital. And then we could put the architect in touch with the resident group directly and take out marketing, sales, you know, take out the basement, take out the second bathrooms, take out the swimming pools, the gyms, take out all the stuff that people didn't need and instead focus on a great housing outcome. And, you know, as we started work on that, you know, I then wrote to, you know, a bunch of architects in Melbourne and asked them if they would come and join, you know, the revolution. And six other architects wrote straight back to me and said that, you know, that they were going to come and join and they put in their own money to help Nightingale One happen. And that was, you know, Simon O'Brien from Six Degrees, you know, Andrew Maynard from Austin Maynard, James Legg from Six Degrees, Claire Cousins, Michael Roper and Nick James from Architecture Architecture, Jerry Wolveridge from Wolveridge Architects, you know, this incredible group of people kind of, you know, came together to say, yeah, let's do this, you know. And then the idea was that as we finished that project, we would then share our IP with those other architects and then they would go and build their own Nightingale building. And then we would then, you know, they would then share their IP with the next architect and they would go and do it. And that architects would essentially lead this housing revolution. That was the idea of Nightingale Housing. And that Nightingale Housing would be a triple bottom line housing model that would cap the returns to the investors at 15%. You know, that was the idea. And through that, through this idea of an architecture of reductionism, focusing on housing rather than an architecture of kind of bells and whistles, and a financial model that kind of capped profits rather than tried to maximize profits, and an architecture that focused on building community within the building and kind of engaging community without, that it felt like all of those things made sense. And when we started it, you know, people had been, you know, contacting us, but, you know, writing to Breathe saying, could we be, you know, if you're doing another building like the Commons here, let us know. And by the time we went to ballot the first Nightingale building, there was, you know, like I think 57 people entered the ballot, you know. And, you know, the last time, you know, Dan McKenna from Nightingale Housing told me what the numbers were like, there's now 14,000 people on a waiting list. So, you know, it's grown. There's incredible latent demand for this sort of thing.
So that first sense that you got that this type of model could work, was that when you started getting letters from people saying that they wanted to be involved? Or was there just, was it more about a gut feel that this type of thing could work?
Look, you know, I definitely had a gut instinct that, you know, the like after the Commons sold incredibly well in a pretty flat market after the GFC. You know, and from a broad range of demographics, right, you know, older baby boomers downsizing, you know, Gen Xers, you know, looking for their first home, but they didn't trust, you know, apartments generally because they thought that they were designed poorly and built poorly and didn't offer great amenity. And so people, a lot of first home buyers in the Commons and a lot of people downsizing into something that they thought they could age gracefully in. So we knew from the Commons that there was latent demand, but we didn't know just how much. We knew the housing model was broken, like we'd been seeing, you know, I'd been watching, you know, what was happening in the 2016 census, you know, despite being the third richest country in the OECD nations, you know, we had 116,000 people experiencing homelessness. Like it just didn't make, those things didn't make sense. You know, after tax reform in 2006, by the then Howard government, you know, I think that the unintended consequences of negative gearing and capital gains tax exemptions meant that people owning more than one property in Australia skyrocketed since 2006. So now 20%, one in five people own two or more properties in Australia. And if across that same time since 2006, home ownership for people aged under 35 has plummeted, you know, for the first time since 1947, it's below 50%. And so, and then we've seen, you know, house prices, you know, now, you know, at record high, so that, yeah, people just don't know how to access the housing market anymore. And so people looking like being, you know, lifelong renters now, but with a really unsophisticated rental market that's, you know, largely owned by mum and dad investors that don't care about kind of, you know, long-term rental tenure or what it's like to live there or, you know, not particularly good kind of rental rights, you know. And unlike, you know, Austria, where the state owns, you know, nearly all of the rental housing and it's good quality, it's well maintained and it's affordable, here there's, you know, all of these people, you know, playing monopoly with people's lives. So, you know, of course it made total sense that it would work, but, you know, when these other architects, you know, started writing back to us saying, yes, we want to be part of it, I think that that's when we knew that it was interesting. And the other thing is that, you know, other mum and dad investors, people who, you know, lived around Brunswick who'd said that they would invest, you know, that they would put, you know, they would put their own money in to try and make this work because they thought it was important and much more interested in the outcome than, you know, their financial returns. So, yeah, we knew there was something there. And I think the other thing was that when we ran a ballot to sell the apartments and we sold the whole building in one day off a ballot, you know, for 57 people and we had 20 apartments, I think that that's when we knew that, you know, there was something to this.
You've touched on some of the ways that a Nightingale building is different from a traditional development, and I'd love to hear a bit more about that. But would also be interested to hear a bit about the ways that the Nightingale organisation itself is designed differently to other businesses, so that it can deliver, you know, good results for community and for residents.
The principles of Nightingale Housing as a kind of, you know, as an architectural outcome are pretty simple. So it's about, you know, this idea of building less to give more. It's about understanding that housing is a basic human right, that car parking isn't, and that what people actually need is safe and secure, affordable housing and not, you know, glitzy bathrooms or, swimming pools and expensive kind of shared facilities. But they do need a place that has a sense of community. So, you know, what does that all look like? And so this idea of building less to give more, you know, basically there's a materials handbook that comes, you know, that Nightingale Housing now holds. And it starts by talking about, you know, if you don't need it, take it out. And so starting at the really simple things, like, you know, if we're building next to a train station and a bike path, then, you know, don't build a – and I'm just going to let my – now I have to let my dog out, Ben.
That's fine. No problem.
You know, whatever he wants. You know, he's a very important individual. So Nightingale's fundamental design principles are around an architecture of reductionism, build less, give more. So starting at the – with the simple things, if you're building next to a train station, take the basement car parking out, put in, you know – great bike parking facilities, end of trip facilities, you know, put in, you know, e-bike charging stations, you know, or maybe it's a car share hub, you know, with some electric car charging facilities in there. So what we've found is that, you know, building around inner city Melbourne, that we can save about $40,000 out of the cost of people's houses by taking out the car parks, for example, which is pretty significant, you know, when you're selling a one-bedroom apartment at, you know, $410,000, right? It's, you know, it's 10%, nearly 10% of your housing price, you know, you can reduce that by. We take out the second bathroom. So there's no en-suites, you know, it's one bathroom and that will do, like, you know, like it is in Barcelona. You know, and we take out even the individual laundries and put a shared rooftop laundry on. And each of these things aren't just about, you know, making the apartments more affordable. It also makes them a little bit more spacious. So when you take out you know, a bathroom at 7 square meters, for example, or a European laundry at 2 square meters, that extra 9 square meters can go back into the living or the dining area into the apartment. So the apartment becomes more spacious in the place where you live in that apartment rather than, you know, the place where you're bathing. But also, you know, from an embodied energy point of view, you're taking out, you know, imagine taking out all of the plumbing fittings, fixtures, you know, all of the stuff that goes into making a bathroom. You're taking that out of, you know, all of the en suites that could have potentially been in the building. And then if you take out, you know, in Nightingale 1, for example, 20 individual laundries, and instead you put in one consolidated laundry on the roof, which, you know, has a great rooftop garden. It's got a, you know, access to a beautiful, you know, rooftop lawn area. It's got a view out over the city. But at the same time, it's a place where everyone can come together, and you've only got 6 washing machines shared between, you know, 40 residents, rather than, you know, 20 washing machines, 20 troughs, you know, 40 taps, you know, 20 tun dishes and all of the stuff that goes with it. So it's a much better spend. You get a much better utilization of those washing machines, and it actually helps, you know, it becomes this central point in the building in which everyone comes together. So it's as cheesy as it sounds, it actually does help build community, because it's a really simple space that everyone needs to use. And, you know, at my time in the Commons, that's where I met many of my neighbours in the laundry, you know, and some of whom, you know, I'm still incredibly good friends with today.
And what about the design of the business?
Oh, design of the business, yeah. So, you know, how does Nightingale run as a business? Well, initially it was never meant to be a business, right? Yeah. Nightingale was an idea. It started as an idea and was meant to be a model that you know, would essentially be really light touch, and there was meant to be like an online repository of information, you know. And so basically, you know, I thought that when we started it, we'd have a couple of smart people uploading IP and sharing with other people, and then we'd have, you know, a board which would then get a licensing committee to make sure that only the greatest Australian architects were getting Nightingale licenses, and that those Nightingale licenses could then be trusted to deliver Nightingale buildings. That was the idea, right, that Nightingale could essentially scale infinitely with a couple of people just sharing case studies from previous buildings, and then it would be led by, you know, each architect doing their own project. That was the beautiful idea. And what happened over time, you know, so Nightingale 1, you know, the prototype building, it became very, very difficult to get debt for that building, because as an architect, I didn't have a proven track record as a property developer. So I had to speak to 34 different banks over the course of about 9 months before I could secure senior debt of $6 million to build it. It was incredibly challenging and very, very time consuming. Getting the debt became a very big hurdle to making that project happen. And then when Nightingale 2 was built, I think that, you know, 6 Degrees came across the same problem. And so very, very late in the piece, it looked like their funding from not one of the big 4 banks, but their funding was very, very challenging. And so...
So with a project like this, where you do have some private funding as well, is the issue that it's very difficult to secure enough private funding to cover the whole building?
Well, the way that you structure it is that you try to get as much debt as possible, because debt at the moment is cheap.
Right.
But equity is expensive. So even at a concessional rate of 15% per annum, you can appreciate that, you know, at Nightingale 1, you know, if we sourced $3 million worth of equity, it costs us $450,000 every year that project's running for that equity.
Right.
And that costs, right? So that cost is like $1.35 million.
Yeah.
That then goes on to the cost of someone's house, right? It adds cost to everyone's house. Whereas debt, you know, if we can source debt at 4%, you know, so we try to get 70% debt, and that is much, much cheaper. And so that makes housing cheaper. And if one of our key missions is to deliver more affordable housing, that's key. But to borrow money at cheap debt, the bank needs to know that their money's safe. So it's cheap because it's low risk for them.
And so to make it low risk, they need a couple of things. Firstly, they need a director's guarantee. So they need someone to sign, to securitize the loan, right? So at Nightingale One, that was, you know, Tam and I. So if the project couldn't pay for it, theoretically the bank could come after me for the $6 million that they needed. And then the second thing that they need is proven track record, you know, to know that the project's going to be delivered, you know, on time and on budget. And you can appreciate what that's like for a bank. And it was one of the things that I hadn't really anticipated, you know, with the idea of the Nightingale model. And so what happened, you know, with Nightingale 2 was that it became very, very challenging for Nightingale 2 to secure senior debt. So the Nightingale board and I worked with National Australia Bank. We built what's called a security trust deed and a security trust pool where, you know, Nightingale Housing essentially, you know, becomes party to the loan for the debt. And so for Nightingale 2, it meant that me at the time, you know, as one of the directors of Nightingale Housing had to sign, you know, the senior debt piece for Nightingale 2, you know, so alongside James Leigh from Six Degrees. And then by the time we get to Nightingale 3 or AMA Terrace House, you know, again, I had to sign, well, Nightingale Housing had to sign the senior debt piece for that, which is challenging when we're not involved in the day-to-day running of those projects. And there is risk associated with that, obviously. So other Nightingale projects, you know, so we, you know, over that time, you know, Nightingale licensed, you know, 33 architects, you know, so we put together a licensing committee of, you know, state government architects and kind of industry leaders like Andy Fergus and Claire Cousins. You know, and so the licensing committee met and licensed about 33 architects, a course of, you know, 2 or 3 years. And then when each of those architects got the license, they could go and source their funds and go and buy sites and build Nightingales. And what happened was that many of those 33 architects really struggled to source their equity to get people to invest in it. And they found it nearly impossible to secure debt to build the projects. And so Nightingale stalled as an idea, you know, because money, because, you know, the way that it actually really works. And so at that point, Nightingale Housing, you know, changed its, you know, we pivoted and we said, if we're going to build Nightingale buildings, we need to be the ones that are sourcing the debt. And then we need to be the ones that are sourcing the equity to make it flow. And then if you're going to source the debt, the bank needs to know that you're going to deliver the project on time. And so we needed to be the ones that had the delivery team that could guarantee, you know, on-time delivery, you know. And so Nightingale in, you know, over, you know, the recent years has brought in-house, you know, a finance manager, and that's Duncan's job, and his job is to go and get finance. And the incredible thing about that is that now he's getting equity not at 15%, not at 13%, not at 11%, not at 10%, but now at 8%, you know, because of, you know, a success, you know, it started at 13%, then it went to 11%, then it went to 10%, and now it's at 8%. So he's getting equity at nearly half the price of that Nightingale One paid for it. So the cost of housing has come down drastically as a result of that. And then we've got, you know, a delivery team, you know, with incredibly dedicated kind of, you know, development managers, most of them that are architects in their background, who handle, you know, the delivery side. And then we've got, you know, people like Toby and Jess, who are kind of community managers, and they engage with the community and the residents and kind of, you know, make sure that, you know, we're getting feedback from the residents about what it is that they need. And then Dan McKenna, you know, who's been at Nightingale, he was like the first employee at Nightingale. You know, he's been there since the start, you know. And, his job is to try and hold it all together. And so the business model now is that, you know, Nightingale started as a social enterprise and it's just recently changed to a not-for-profit. But apart from that, I mean, you know, Nightingale, you know, probably functions like, let's say it like a development company with a lot more control now, but profit isn't one of its motives. So as a not-for-profit, that's off the table. So instead, the only thing that Nightingale needs to care about is, you know, building carbon-neutral homes and building community. And that's incredibly, incredibly liberating. You know, once you take the profit motive off the table, it means that the focus is very, very clear.
I also wanted to ask you about the not-for-profit model. So Nightingale's operating as a not-for-profit in a traditionally profit-driven industry, and it's allowed you to focus on the delivery of your mission rather than just the profit. So I'm wondering if you see that there's an opportunity for businesses and enterprises in other industries to operate as a not-for-profit and, you know, have a focus that is a mission which you know, serves the broader community.
Well, I mean, there is. I mean, if you think about the housing space, it is incredible how many people, and one of the things that has been incredibly clarifying for us at Nightingale Housing over the past 3 years has been working with organisations like Housing All Australians by Rob Pradlin, which is a not-for-profit, you know, and they've dedicated, you know, everything that they do to trying to solve, you know, a very big housing problem, you know. We get to work with Jeanette Large from Women's Property Initiatives and see, you know, community housing providers like Women's Property Initiatives and Housing Choices Australia with people like James Henry and Michael Lennon to see how committed these people are to trying to solve, you know, housing problems. So, you know, there's something like 36, you know, community housing providers in Victoria. They're all not-for-profits or charitable organisations, all 100% committed to trying to solve for the housing crisis that we have. And then we're seeing organisations like coming out of New South Wales like Hope Housing, you know, where their chairperson is the former head of First State Super. So, you know, like we think, you know, incredibly smart, incredibly powerful people looking to, you know, use their influence and experience in financial markets to try and solve, particularly for first home buyers. You know, and so we're seeing organised, and in Melbourne we've got the Barnett Foundation that are trying to build shared equity housing to get people, you know, into home ownership out of social housing. So transition aspirational social housing tenants into housing. So, and all of those are not-for-profits or charitable organisations, you know, and all of, and for a lot of those organisations, their key team members have come from for-profit corporate Australia, and they're all now working on mission-based, issues now. So, yeah, I think that there's a massive opportunity.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it. I'd love to hear a bit more about some of the projects that Nightingale's got on at the moment, and in particular the Nightingale Village, which I was lucky enough to purchase, well, not exactly into the village, but into a building that is very close to the village.
It's still part of the village.
Is it? I'm very happy to hear that.
Yeah, sure. You know, if we think about, you know, Nightingale 1 in Anstey Urban Village in Brunswick, Nightingale 2 next to Fairfield Train Station, Nightingale 3 or AMA Terrace House on Sydney Road, Brunswick, which is just coming up to completion, Nightingale Brunswick East, which is completed on the number 96 tram line, Nightingale Ballarat, which will complete at the end of this year, incredible kind of regional project. Nightingale Station and Laneway, which is the building that you're in, you know, immediately adjacent to Anstey Station on the upfield bike path, and kind of an incredible engagement with the bike path and the train station, and providing a lot of kind of urban amenity there. Immediately across Albion Street from there is the four communities that are Wurrubwurru, Lark, Narwan and Yambook, and that's just balloted. And then, you know, going south of Nightingale 1 by 200 metres. So all this happens within, most of this stuff in Brunswick happens within a kind of, you know, 500 metre radius of each other. So it's all part of the village. But Nightingale Village proper, which is on Duckett Street, two buildings on the north side of Duckett Street, which is Evergreen by Claire Cousins, Park Life by Austin Maynard, and on the south side, Kennedy Nolan's left field building, Hayball's courtyard building and Breathe Sky House building. And then, you know, on Hope Street is the Urban Coop project, the intentional community, which is a Nightingale building, which is done in collaboration with Architecture. So all of that kind of happens. And then Duckett Street, which sits in the middle of Nightingale Village, you know, open work, worked with Andy Fergus on that project, but that's, you know, this incredible kind of public realm in there, you know, so it's all about people and not about cars. So that street's going to be, you know, transformed from asphalt to, you know, a place for people, which I'm pretty excited about. And then, you know, further afield, we're working with a church group in Sydney to do Nightingale Marrickville, and SJB Sydney are doing that. They've done kind of incredible work up there with the Nightingale team. And then in Adelaide, Nightingale Bowden with Renewal South Australia. And that's a partnership with Housing Choices Australia. And that's half affordable housing and half Nightingale. And also the South Australian Housing Authority actually, you know, got involved to try and help, you know, solve that housing issue there. So, you know, that's in the Bowden precinct there. You know, so, yeah, there's... you know,
yeah, there's a lot on.
There's a lot on. And then, you know, yeah, and Nightingale Preston, actually, which is just about to ballot in about a month's time. And Nightingale Preston, you know, is a collaboration with MAB. And so they came in and there's a social housing building, there's a Nightingale building, there's townhouses by Archia, and there's straight-to-market apartments. And that's right next to an Assemble project, and next to a property collectives project. Like that little pocket of Preston is going to be, you know, this incredible kind of living example of, you know, of new housing typologies, you know. So I'm pretty excited about that.
So with the village, which is an evolution of the original single building idea of Nightingale into a, you know, a multiple building context, I'm wondering if the goal changes a bit. Because you not only have this community, or you not only have building-based communities, but you've also got a larger precinct-based community. So, yeah, could you talk a little bit about how the outcome shifts and what you start to aim for?
So the village is really hard, right? It's six buildings by six different architects all come together, built by one builder. But it's incredibly rich as a result of that. So... you can imagine that you've got, you know, six of the country's best architects, you know, in a room all talking about, you know, how that, what their take on Nightingale should be and how their community can thrive. So look, you know, it's pretty rich, the village. There's incredible opportunity to precinct scale, right? So you're not just building a carbon neutral building, but you're building a carbon neutral precinct, you know. And then you get to share things like, you know, your packaged heat pump or your solar arrays or, I mean, interestingly, we've worked really hard to consolidate, you know, all of the services connections into the building. So we've got, you know, one substation, one water meter assembly, you know, you know, like, you know, we're grouping like the water tank and water storage, the fire services, and all that stuff sounds pretty boring, right? Until you've tried to build a multi-res building and then activate the street and have, you know, active frontages and shop fronts and hospitality or little offices or, you know, maker spaces in your building. But you can't fit anything in there because you've got all the services that the authorities want you to put, you know, close to the street so they can access it.
It's always a battle.
Yeah. So in this instance, by being able to consolidate those things, it's liberated the entire ground floor in the village to be active and engage with the street. So, you know, and then obviously, you know, just being able to build, you know, a consolidated bike park between, you know, under three of the buildings that's got, you know, 450 bikes in it. to build a car share hub for the entire village that's got 15 cars, you know, in there that everyone gets to share, and along with the rest of the community. And and then obviously waste streams, being able to think about how do we consolidate waste in the building, you know, like what are the big sustainability moves that we can do that we couldn't afford in a single building, but that we can share, you know, in a village setting. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting, the village.
Can you talk a bit more about how you're dealing with waste?
Yeah, sure. So, of course, yeah, that's one of your waste is a big thing for you. So Bonnie Herring worked really closely with the other architects and obviously our consultants about, you know, what do the waste streams look like at the village? And importantly, there's 7 waste streams, you know. So it's not just commingled recycling, you know, and landfill, you know. There's e-waste, there's soft plastics, there's organics, there's cardboard, there's commingled, there's landfill, and there's something else that I can't even think of. You know, Bonnie Herring would be able to tell you what it is. But also things like bulk buy laundry liquid, like sustainable laundry liquid from Miss V, the non-toxic cleaner, goes in each of the laundries. And then downstairs in the cleaner's room in one of the buildings, is a product called e-water. And e-water is basically you put in salt, you know, in one part of it, and then it's plumbed into water in another part, and then you put in electricity and it ionizes the water and it splits it into 2 parts. One of it is a sanitizer and one's a cleaning product. Wow. So just thinking through how do we stop buying cleaning products into the building in plastic bottles, you know, like thinking through, you know, all of those things. I mean, it's been really incredible to look at Nightingale One and to see the tiny amount of, you know, for 20 apartments, there's only 3 landfill bins there, you know. Everything else is going off to, you know, organics or commingled recycling or the worm farms.
I currently live in a rental apartment, and experiencing the refuse rooms in a apartment building of, say, 80 apartments, it is an experience, I can tell you. And it's not just that there is only 2 waste streams, and that's commingled recycling and just, you know, landfill waste. It seems that it's very difficult to get people to just even properly use both those waste streams. So what I'm wondering is how you onboard people in a community like the Nightingale Village. So not only are they prepared to separate their waste into the 7 streams, they actually want to do it.
Well, it's probably the game's probably rigged for Nightingale from the outset. So when you have an information session for Nightingale and you talk to people about that, you know, you're building a carbon neutral building, it's going to be carbon neutral in operations, and you talk about the importance of sustainability, you talk about things like waste, and you talk about the fact that, you know, our thermal modelling shows that we don't need air conditioning, you know, because the building's highly thermally efficient and there's not going to be cars. And we talk about the sustainability mission, you know, about reduction in emissions. And so the type of people that ballot in, they already care deeply about the environment. They're already really engaged in their own lives in kind of, reducing their own, you know, carbon footprint and their own waste footprint. So we get a bunch of people that are generally very, very engaged with that anyway when they move in. And then it's just education. So it's kind of the first few weeks in a Nightingale building are generally pretty hectic, you know, as people try and find their way. But what we've found in every building is that there's always a couple of waste champions, right, which step up. And so, that you know, if someone hasn't broken in their boxes or they put it in the wrong place, you know, they kind of sort that out. They'll leave notes on the board and there'll be, you know, so there's initial education and then you need constant education.
So waste enforces, basically.
Yeah, correct. But you do need constant education in a building or in anywhere, right, because there's movement, you know, so over the course of a year, maybe someone moves out at the end of the year and so you've got to onboard those new residents and explain to them how it
absolutely
all works.
Absolutely, yeah.
And why it's important. So, yeah, and then also, like, you know, one of the requirements under the Nightingale ballot is that, you know, you need to attend, you know, it says, you know, this is what you can expect from Nightingale, but what does Nightingale expect from you? And it says that, you know, Nightingale expects all the residents to get together twice a year for working bees and twice a year for kind of, you know, a community meeting to talk about, you know, how can they make their community better or how can they contribute from their community. And it's, you know, it's not a Nightingale idea. You know, we learned that from, you know, a co-housing group in Zurich, that it's really important, you know, to expect something of your residents to give back to their community and the broader community. And that, you know, in doing that, that the residents have a sense of purpose, a sense of connection, a sense of ownership over their own building, their community, and kind of, you know, the future of that community.
It does quite clearly outline the challenge, because you might be able to put the best infrastructure available in your neighbourhood, but if people aren't engaged with it, then it will be very difficult to get it to work, because the people are obviously what make these things work. So it seems that education part is very critical. And for Nightingale, the education is ongoing, but also it, you know, people do tend to come with a bit of education. So it does sound like it's a challenge.
I mean, obviously some people don't, but it gets better over time. Like, you know, when Nightingale One first opened, you know, one of the residents was exasperated, you know, when he said to me, you know, like they're putting onions and orange peels in the worm farm and, you know, they haven't broken in their boxes, you know, correctly. And we had a big conversation about it. And I'm like, yeah, but you've got to go and look at the building next door. This is actually incredible, you know. And people don't know that citrus and onions aren't good for the worm farm. So we just educate them and then, you know, and so, but over time, Nightingale One has become incredible. Like, it's a waste minimization machine.
Could you talk a bit about the difference between carbon neutral in operations and embodied energy?
Yeah, sure. So there's two parts to carbon, you know, in a building. And we know that, you know, our buildings, you know, make up 39% of our carbon footprint in Australia. And so the built environment, it's so important that we get that right. And then of that, you know, let's call it nearly 40% of our carbon emissions in this country come from the built environment. And so of that, it's about kind of two-thirds, one-third, you know, two-thirds operational energy or carbon emissions and one-third, you know, embodied carbon. And obviously that varies building to building, depending on how long the building stands for. So our focus at Nightingale has always been on the low-hanging fruit. So the easiest thing to fix any day of the week is operational carbon. And the reason for that is that there's a couple of really simple levers that we can pull. And so the first lever is no gas. So if we're planning for, you know, a net zero emissions, you know, country by 2050, we cannot be plumbing gas into any of our buildings. So we have to build a pathway for net zero emissions. So we take all the gas out, which means we 100% electrify every Nightingale building. And if it's 100% electric, then the other key part of that is, where do you buy your electricity from? You know, and so the other big piece that we do at Nightingale Housing is that James Senior, who works at Nightingale Housing, he's our partnerships manager, has worked to basically bulk buy 100% green power for all of the Nightingale buildings. And so we can all go out there today and buy 100% green power. So from any of our, you know, major energy retailers. And the importance of 100% green power is that that's our independently audited, accredited system in Australia to make sure that there's no carbon associated with operations of or the electricity that we're using. And
so there's no fossil fuel burning in the generation of that electricity?
Well, no, I mean, there is, because obviously you can imagine that when the way that our national energy market works is that there's a coal generation plant over there. It might be black coal there, brown coal there. There's a gas turbine there. There's some hydro coming in there, and then there's some wind in there. But it's like the stock market, right? All of these things come together to create a market. And so while the electrons that we're buying might have been generated, you know, in the Latrobe Valley from a coal-fired power plant, in the energy mix, you know, if we know that 30% of energy is coming from wind and solar, and when the the energy retailers are selling energy, if the demand through market forces is for a higher percentage of 100% green power, so wind, hydro, solar, then the national energy market has to increase production of renewables. So it's the market signal that changes the energy mix from coal, from black and brown, to renewables. So when we buy 100% green power, what we're doing is essentially, you know, telling the energy generators what sort of power they need to be providing for us. And so it has long-term implications for investment in large-scale, you know, renewable generation. So, but also, you know, basically what it means is that that green power, when you're buying certified green power, you know that across the energy mix that that you're not going to have a carbon footprint from your power purchase. So that's the easy thing to do, right? Take out the gas, buy 100% certified green power. Easy two things. You know, the one thing that our buildings, you know, don't do at the moment is pay for carbon offsets for other things like, you know, waste production or other things like that. And that's something that we're leaving to each of the buildings to operate. The other harder thing is embodied carbon. So when you build a building, you know, we've only done a life cycle assessment on one building to date, and that's the building that you're in, Ben. That's Station and Laneway. And what a life cycle assessment does is it looks at, you know, everything that goes into the building. So all the concrete, you know, the steel, the timber, where it comes from, and is it a carbon sequester like some forms of timber, or is it a carbon emitter like concrete? And there's lots of concrete in, you know, in our buildings. Even though in your building we have 46% recycled content, you know, making up the concrete. So it's an incredibly, you know, good, you know, mix. It's not that much Portland cement in your building. The life cycle assessment then says how much carbon has been generated by transport to site, by the materials, the generation of the materials that have gone to their site. Have we specified carbon neutral materials, you know, in which case we've bought a carbon neutral tapware from Sussex, in which case there's no carbon footprint associated with that. Have we brought carbon neutral bricks from Brickworks, in which case there's no carbon footprint associated with that. And at the end of the project, we have, or the end of that assessment, we have a carbon calculator, which tells us how much carbon has gone into your building. And then it's obviously through that process that helps us make decisions about choosing materials that are less carbon intensive. And then we look at the life cycle of those materials over the life of the building. And so if we're predicting that that building's going to last 100 years or it's designed to last 100 years, and some of those materials are super efficient and very robust and don't need to be replaced, you know, at what point does that get paid down for, or that does that carbon get paid for if we're producing or if we're buying carbon offsets over time? And then we get to a final position where we get to make a decision about how do we buy carbon offsets to make sure that when you move into your building, it has a zero carbon, you know, we've zeroed out all the carbon that's gone into it. And so, you know, we're, you know, obviously working with, you know, organisations like the Carbon Reduction Institute, Pangolin, who do carbon audits and offsetting, and also with Greenfleet about nature-based offsets, you know, so the IPCC tells us that we should buy nature-based offsets. So in the importance of and embodied energy is harder because, you know, we need, you know, skilled, you know, engineers and assessors and independent engineers and assessors to assess everything that goes into a building to work out how much carbon is in there. And then we need brokers to go and broker how much carbon we need to buy and what sort of carbon credits are we going to buy that are going to be meaningful. And then Nightingale Housing as an organisation, it was a pretty easy choice for us if we're saying that, you know, it's important to build carbon neutral buildings, then Nightingale Housing had to be a carbon neutral organisation. And again, we just worked with the Carbon Reduction Institute and one of their engineers assessed all of the carbon that went into, you know, the Nightingale Housing as an organisation. So how much does our office use, you know, do we have any flights, you know, do we take, you know, Ubers places, what are all the carbon from, you know, that we generate as an organisation, and then how do we minimise that carbon? You know, can we reduce flights? Can we do more teleconferencing, more Zooms? You know, all of those things. And then finally, you know, how do we broker our offsets, and where do we buy our offsets on, you know, offsets from, to make sure that as an organisation we have, you know, a net zero impact on the planet in terms of carbon emissions. And that's something that any organisation can do, like through Pangolin or Carbon Reduction Institute, very, very simple.
There's a number of different rating systems and sustainability tools now out there in the market, and they provide a set of parameters for people to design to, but they also give us a scorecard so that we can compare the performance of a particular building or design. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about which ones you guys use and which ones you think are working really, really well.
So the guiding light for us is the Green Building Council. So, you know, where possible, you know, we do Green Star buildings. Green Star are looking at rolling out Green Star homes. They're looking at Green Star apartments. You know, their daylighting, you know, requirements are really clear and stringent. Like, you know, so for us, the Green Building Council, you know, worldwide, and the Green Building Council of Australia are, you know, what we think are the peak body in terms of kind of, you know, environmental standards. But, you know, at the moment we use NatHERS, but there's a new product that's out at the moment called Hero, which we think is incredibly elegant. So
Hero, did you say?
Yeah, H-E-R-O. Yep.
Okay.
And so that does the same thing as NatHERS, but just in a, you know, a more elegant, you know, intuitive way. So, yeah. Tools are important, you know, and as frustrating as it is, you know, like you can build an apartment building and have apartments that are only 5-star energy efficient. You know, you've got to have an average of 6, but you can have apartments that are only 5 stars, and our minimum is 7.5 stars, you know. And, you know, remember that, you know, 10 stars under the NatHERS rating means you don't require any energy for heating or cooling. So that's the panacea. So, and while our minimum is 7.5 stars, our average in most buildings are out over 8, because obviously, you know, you've got some apartments that are 7.5 stars hitting the minimum, but you've got others, you know, rating out at 9 stars.
So Passive House is another, like a both an accreditation system, but also a kind of performative methodology for achieving highly efficient buildings, which I know you would know all about. It's a German methodology. So could you talk a little bit about Passive House? And I'm just wondering if that is something you might also consider for Nightingale at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. So Passive House uses kind of two key, you know, well, probably three key kind of performance, you know, tools. So one is air tightness. So, you know, Australian buildings are notoriously leaky, and not so much a problem for us in apartments, but, you know, in freestanding dwellings, you know, that and when I say leaky is that the air just kind of, you know, they're very drafty, so air just kind of moves through them. And so it's very difficult to, you know, efficiently heat or cool a space when the air is constantly just leaking out or leaking into a space. So one is air tightness. The other one is thermal efficiency. So, you know, Passive House, you know, demands a very high measure of thermal efficiency. And also it looks really closely at glazing. So kind of using, you know, double and triple glazing in all the right spots. So some pretty smart kind of glazing technologies. You know, so that you've got an airtight building or relatively airtight building, very high thermal efficiency. And so when you put those two things together, it means that you need very low inputs of energy to keep a dwelling at a particular temperature, right? Because the hot air can't get in, you know, and the cool air, you know, can't get out, you know, in summer, for example. The problem with that, of course, is that, you know, if you make something too airtight, the occupants will suffocate, right? So as we breathe in oxygen and we exhale carbon dioxide, we need fresh air. And so what Passive House, the third part of that is it demands that you put in what's called energy recovery ventilation. And so what that does is that it brings fresh air into that building, and so make sure that there's plenty of fresh oxygen in a dwelling, but at the same time it uses heat exchangers to preheat or pre-cool that air. So it pre-cools it in summer and it preheats it in winter. So while you're bringing in fresh air, it's not just coming in from the outside and messing up your thermal balance. It's actually coming in a controlled way. So, you know, it's a pretty simple idea. And Nightingale has obviously been looking at that. The challenges for us are around, at the moment, are around affordability. And also, you know, for us, we need more data to find out, you know, how that performs in a, you know, in a Melbourne climate, for example, in a multi-res, you know, setting. So it seems to make total sense for us. But at the moment, Nightingale relies on a very, very low-tech setting. So you remember, it's a sustainability reductionism. It's kind of stripping things out that you don't need. And so Nightingale One, for example, you know, we're seeing energy bills in there, you know, on a one-bedroom apartment at $26 a month and in a two-bedroom apartment at kind of $39 a month, you know. And so the way that those apartments are working is, you know, basically, you know, very thermally efficient buildings. They're very airtight just through function of, you know, the way that we build apartment buildings. And the missing piece of the puzzle for us is the makeup air, is that fresh air. And so people are now using, you know, they use windows, right, to cross ventilate through there, which historically has been fine. The challenge that we've got is with a heating climate, you know, and you get, you know, if we're seeing, you know, patterns now, which we are, of heat wave events, you know, not just lasting 1 or 2 days, but lasting 4 days, and if that's happening regularly, then it's not reasonable to expect someone to be able to cool their apartment, you know, by just opening their windows at nighttime when the nighttime temperature drops, if it doesn't drop for 4 days. So I think that the fresh air component is, you know, that's the biggest interest from us at Nightingale. And then also the other thing with that very thermally tight building, or sorry, very airtight building, is condensation. And so the other thing that the energy recovery ventilation does is that it deals with, you know, any condensation. So, you know, how do you make sure that you're not getting, you know, mold issues in the building?
Do you have a figure for the kind of cost increase that something like a passive house would be for a Nightingale building?
I will have in about 6 weeks, Ben.
All right, come back to me. Yep. With something like, you know, you're weighing up whether to implement a passive house, or you've already got a system that works pretty well. And obviously the passive house system, as you've explained, has a lot more complications to it. How do you weigh up when to go very hard on a particular, you know, sustainability initiative, or when to compromise?
Yeah, look, I mean, really good question. I think that, and just to clarify for us, we're not looking at a passive house certified project. We're looking at ERVs. And so we're acknowledging that, you know, our buildings aren't as, we don't have the same airtightness that passive houses are chasing, but, you know, we're pretty close. So,
and an ERV is a
energy recovery ventilation unit.
Right, yes.
Yeah. So, so I think that for us, it would be, you know, we're interested in, if that's right, if it's not broke, don't fix it. But we're in a changing climate. And the technology's, you know, the technology's been used in Europe for, you know, 40 years. So, you know, and we acknowledge that we're just a long way behind them and we should be up to date. And the idea of fresh air in dwellings, but in an urban setting, still being able to get that fresh air with your windows closed is pretty good when you're close to a train line or close to a tram line, or potential noise sources, you know, and you want to be able to, you know, control acoustics as well. So you've got a lot of kind of competing things happening at once. So I think, to be totally honest, Ben, what we're planning to do is to actually roll this out in different degrees across a number of buildings. And then we're working with, you know, researchers like Trevis Moore from RMIT to get data back on what are the internal temperatures like? What's the energy consumption like? Like, does the ERV use more energy than our previous Nightingales because it's running 24/7? You know, is it a centralized system? Is it a decentralized system? And so we want to run a few case studies against, you know, in something like your building, for example, like that would be perfect where you've got two communities. You know, you do ERVs in one and not in the other, and then you'd look at, you know, what is the data telling us about, you know, internal air quality, internal temperatures and energy usage, you know, and then we'd be able to have some data which would give us a pretty clear pathway forward. So that's our move at the moment, Ben McConnor. You know, the next 3 years looks like, you know, a fact-finding mission for us.
Yeah, so it's a data-driven approach and then just sort of, I suppose, a research by design, if you like, approach where you're testing things and then comparing the results.
We have been pretty lucky, like with, you know, Dr. Travis Moore, you know, Katie Skillington from Melbourne University, Dr. Andrea Sharam, Dr. Thomas Alves, Jasmine Palmer. You know, we've had a lot of academics who have put a lot of work into Nightingale to try and understand what's working and what's not. And what can be tweaked, you know, and what are the settings that we should be tweaking?
Yeah. One of the things I've heard about living in a passive house is that the thermal comfort is very consistent and it's quite noticeable, and people just talk about what a pleasure that is, really, and how it's not a pleasure we're all that used to in Melbourne, because a lot of us have lived in terrace houses and other, you know, much, much loved, but also poorly, you know, buildings with pretty poor thermal outcomes. So in regards to sustainability, it's always a challenge to communicate to a client that sustainability initiatives in a building actually result in great living, and they're not just something to tack on as a moral obligation. I'm wondering how you have tried to communicate that to clients in your work with Breathe, but also I suppose to a lesser extent with Nightingale. How have you been able to help take people on the journey?
Well, look, I think Nightingale's been really easy, right? Because we've just mandated carbon neutrality, mandated minimum 7.5 stars.
Yep.
You know, so I think that Nightingale, because we built it from the ground up and we've got more demand than we have supply, it's been easy to do that. With Breathe, you know, our approach is we'll take progress over perfection any day of the week. So Breathe used to be incredibly myopic about sustainability, and we would try to do everything simultaneously. And it was complex for clients to understand what were all these things that were happening. And, you know, and so now we talk about, we have a conversation with the clients about their kind of level of engagement with, you know, issues around sustainability. And then we try to simplify it for them. And we step them through things like, you know, firstly, you know, we don't specify gas at Breathe, you know, so that's something that we don't do. And that's a kind of threshold issue for us, you know. Unless someone has existing gas infrastructure, we just won't do it. If they really want to put gas in, that's no problems. But they need to instruct that. They need to put it on the drawings themselves because we won't do it. And we talk to them about, you know, why, you know, for us, it's an ethical imperative that we can't plumb gas into a building knowing that we have to get to zero emissions and that we're responsible for that. And then we spend a fair bit of time with them working through their energy bill and who their energy supplier is and explaining green power. So, you know, Talia Hayes at Breathe has spent all this time kind of researching the national energy market, so she can take any of our clients through that. So if nothing else, if our client still has, you know, an inefficient home, but they're buying 100% electric, but it's 100% electric and it's 100% green power, then, you know, then they don't have any carbon emissions associated with their building footprint, you know. So it's really low-hanging fruit. And then from there we kind of step it up, you know. So all of our houses, you know, we target a minimum 7.5 stars for our houses, you know, same for our apartments. It's really easy in apartments because they kind of insulate each other, much easier for apartments than it is for freestanding houses. And then we've got a Breathe materials handbook, you know, which we're about to put on our website actually to share with everyone, which basically just kind of t- talks through our decision-making kind of matrix on materials and how we get there. So looking at low embodied energy, robust materials, responsibly sourced, and a lot of that stuff is effortless for the client. We don't necessarily talk to them about it because you can still make a beautiful space, and it doesn't have to have a particular aesthetic. It doesn't have to look like a particular sustainability aesthetic. It just is what it is. But there's enough choice in the marketplace now that we can respond to different clients' needs and do it, largely responsibly. So a lot of the time, then we don't have to have a client to sell anything, a tough conversation with the client to sell anything, because, a lot of it just makes sense. Like, heat pumps now are really efficient, they're affordable, and they pay for themselves over time. So if you've got a, so I won't go on, but it's not as hard as it used to be.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's really good to hear. I'd like to also talk about Nightingale's role in shifting the status quo in the industry. And we've touched on this a bit already. The two things I'd love to get your thoughts on are, is it always part of the intention when you're doing something that no one else is doing to shift industry as a whole towards your perceived mission? And what happens then when you get people just superficially applying some of those things? There's that term greenwashing that gets thrown around a bit. So, could you talk about those two things for us?
Well, I mean, let's cover up on the greenwash thing, first of all. I think that it is a real problem. And so one of the benefits of rating systems is that you can't greenwash a rating system, right? So, either you're at 7.5 stars or you're not, either you're 5-star green star or you're not, either you're 100% electric or you're not, either, you're buying 100% green power or you're not. So I think that some of those metrics are really good to solve that, and the same with FSC. Like, we can talk all day about the problem with FSC timber, but until someone can show me an alternative that's better than FSC, we're going to continue to specify FSC timber, because, it's the best that we've got at the moment. So, I do get frustrated. Recently we've been trying to specify furniture, and I've been so frustrated by the broader, particularly the larger furniture producers, and, the way that they talk about sustainability, but then when you actually dig in and ask them where they source their timber from, it's not FSC. It's incredibly frustrating. And when you ask them, can they make it out of FSC timber for you, and you're prepared to pay more, they won't engage with you on it. I mean, let's not go there. But I'm frustrated.
No, you can go there.
I'm frustrated with large furniture producers in Australia at the moment, for some of our bigger clients. For the furniture crew out there, if it's not FSC, don't buy it, all right. So then back to the other question, which is, what was the goal of Nightingale? And if we think back to it, Ben, it was looking at a broken housing system and how do we fix that housing system, or how do we be part of that solution? And Nightingale, we never thought for one minute that Nightingale would be able to fix, an issue where we've got, 116,000 people experiencing homelessness. Like, the problem is vast. But what we did think is that we could act as a bit of a beacon to say there is a different way to do things. And it's really challenging, right, when you're on the board of a big property development company, and you're dealing with other people's, shareholders' money. To do something different is challenging, right? And so Nightingale, I think, as a not-for-profit, has the ability to do things that other bigger companies potentially couldn't do because of their, director's responsibility to their shareholders. So innovation is challenging for property developers. And so by us innovating, I think that we've freed up, and proving that there is a market, and proving that you can build 100% electric buildings, that you can put in a high efficiency heat pump to heat your hot water instead of a gas condenser boiler, that people will buy apartments with induction cooktops once they, go and see what they're like and realize they're 40% more efficient than gas, you know, and that hospitality operators like Honour will, you know, will come and lease hospitality spaces without gas because they're interested in, you know, how do they be part of a zero carbon future. So, yeah, for us, you know, Nightingale and the Commons actually was about, you know, advocacy and an education piece and trying to shift the market, you know, and we're constantly taking people for tours of Nightingale One. So there's every Thursday until COVID, there was a tour that went through that building. And quite often, you know, the Nightingale team are taking through other property developers and real estate agents to show this is what it's like and this is how it works. And, I mean, it's incredible to see, you know, developers like Milieu do their version of Nightingale, like the same environmental standards, minimum 7.5 stars, all electric, you know, 100% green power, embedded network, you know, sharing, you know, all of the cost savings with the residents, you know, doing that, still putting in cars, like, but decoupling car ownership from apartment ownership so you can buy the car space separately, like taking everything that Nightingale tested and then applying it, but applying it kind of in a high design way to their demographic, which is a slightly different demographic to Nightingale, and doing it with absolute class, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, and then we see, yeah, working with partners like MAB in Preston, where they're not just taking the gas out of the Nightingale building, but, you know, in the four other buildings on that site, they're taking the gas out. So they're going all electric across the entire precinct. You know, and then, you know, working at Breathe, we're working with developers now that are saying, well, actually, you know, now seeing that you've already been able to do it, yes, we're happy to do an all-electric building. And then when we go to the display suite to, you know, still build display suites, but when they go to the display suite, these apartments are selling incredibly well. You know, people care about their housing and they care about sustainability. And so, you know, it's definitely, you know, in the inner north, we're, you know, we're working on projects at Breathe in, you know, in Fitzroy and Brunswick and Collingwood, and they're selling incredibly well.
That's great to hear. I think we'll have to leave it there, Jeremy. We've run out of time, but thank you so much for the chat. Hugely insightful and could have kept chatting for a lot longer.
No, thanks heaps, Ben. Good to talk to you, mate. Let's talk about waste some other time.
Absolutely. Cheers.
All right, catch you, mate.
Thanks for listening to Make Good. If you'd like to hear more of Make Good, please subscribe to the show on your podcasting service. If you'd like to learn more about Nightingale Housing, check out www.nightingalehousing.org or their Instagram at instagram.com/nightingale.housing. If you have any feedback at all about the podcast, please email me at makegood@dreamerlab.com.au. The intro and outro music was made by me, Ben Shields. I make music under the name Dull Reality. And this podcast was brought to you by Dreamer. We are an architecture and design studio in Brunswick, Melbourne, Australia. If you'd like to learn more about Dreamer and the work that we do, please visit our website at www.dreamerlab.com.au or get in touch at studio@dreamerlab.com.au. Catch you next time.